You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. It happens to all of us. Right before an important presentation, the printer runs out of ink. Brother Inkvestment Tank Printers help put a stop to this and can literally change the way you ink. With your choice of 1 or 2 years of ink included in box, Inkvestment Tank helps eliminate the expense and hassle of frequently buying and replacing ink cartridges. Learn more at changethewayyouink.com. And now, enjoy the podcast.
If you could remake public education in this country, how would you do it?
That's hard.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
That's what you do?
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's more that schools could be doing? Explain it to me.
Principal, how do you give kids a fair and equitable education?
Smaller class sizes.
Sex ed.
Goat yoga.
That seems dangerous.
Right, okay. When you make a high school curriculum, what's that look like?
Just people who can think outside the box.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
This is awkward.
I've had a few awkward moments with you already.
Really?
I told you don't look in the camera. Stop it.
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was a clip from Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas. The HBO late-night docuseries follows comedian and writer Wyatt Cenac as he explores America's most pressing issues. Cenac is no stranger to late-night comedy. As a longtime writer and correspondent for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, he examined a wide range of social and cultural problems facing Americans. On his HBO series, which is now entering its second season, Wyatt travels around the country from suburban Minneapolis to downtown Cincinnati to rural Texas as he investigates and seeks solutions to the big problems like policing and education, and smaller ones like dealing with crowded sidewalks, trying to get your steps in at the office, and teaching your kids to do taxes. And today, Wyatt comes on the podcast to talk about why he wanted to differentiate problem areas from The Daily Show, the risk of doing a late-night show without a studio audience, and what he hopes to accomplish by having a real conversation with his subjects instead of making fun of them. He talks about checking his own biases to explore the different perspectives on the contentious issue of policing America's communities, what he wants to learn about America's education system in Season 2, and why the topic of school choice has become so controversial. Plus, the college admissions scandal, goat yoga, and more, coming up with Wyatt Cenac in just a moment. Comedian, actor, producer, and Emmy-winning writer Wyatt Cenac was a longtime correspondent and writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and he's currently the producer and host of the HBO late-night series Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas, a show on which he travels to different parts of the country bringing unique perspectives to systemic issues while also tackling more benign everyday inconveniences with his own unique comedic solutions. Season 2 of Problem Areas debuts Friday, April 5th at 11 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Wyatt, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, Wyatt, I was a big fan of you from The Daily Show, and then I instantly became a fan of Problem Areas when it premiered because It is such a unique show within the space of late night television, and I especially love the aesthetics of the show. It's got this great, I don't know, late 70s, early 80s, pre to mid disco era PBS vibe with the music and the set and even the animation that kind of reminds me of public television from when I was a kid. I know that you and I are about the same age in our 40s. Did you grow up with those kind of shows like The Electric Company, Reading Rainbow, I don't know, Mr. Rogers?
I grew up with all those shows, yeah, Sesame Street and 3-2-1 Contact. I watched all of those, and I think as a kid, yeah, PBS was one of those things that you engaged with for those shows, and then also occasionally found yourself a few minutes into the McNeil Lehrer Report, and were also like, I guess this is what television is supposed to be.
What were you going for by not following that usual late night format with the desk and the guest couch and the backdrop of the fake city skyline?
I think for us, the goal was to, one, create a late night show that felt unique and felt like it was both different but also could fit within the landscape. We want to make a funny show, and that is our goal, and our approach is a different one because we don't have a studio audience and we don't have, we don't have guests who are coming on in the same way. For me, going out into the field, those kind of become my guests. Those are the people who I get to talk to. And while they're not pitching a movie or presenting a movie, they're presenting ideas and they're presenting things that weren't familiar to me in some cases and may not be familiar to a lot of people in the audience. And so the audience at home, I mean. And so to me, it felt like, oh, this seems fun. This seems like a fun way to both make a late night show and also talk about some things that aren't necessarily somebody's brand new sitcom or somebody's movie right. or album. And not that there's not a place for those things, but I'm not I talk slow. I'm kind of like a little less excitable. So I might not be the person who can really help sell a big budget Marvel or DC movie.
Yeah, your style of comedy tends to be less over the top, more wry and understated, kind of like people are either in on the joke or they're not on the joke. Is this loose, naturally chill, and possibly high Wyatt Cenac the most authentic version of yourself, or did that evolve over time?
I'd like to think it's the most sort of accurate version of me. I don't know if it's evolved over time. I feel like I've probably been this person for a while. I think when I was in high school and junior high, I definitely was maybe a little more excitable, a little more hyper. But I think I went through peaks and valleys where I was probably at this pace and then could very quickly just get energetic about something and then just come back down to this level. I've always been a person, I think, where people have said it's been hard to find my pulse. So I just leaned into it.
As a performer, is it hard to work without the immediacy of an audience reaction?
It's definitely different. There's definitely a different aspect of it because you're kind of going in and you hope that this thing is funny. And there are the things as we're writing stuff that make us laugh in the room, and you're not sure whether or not it's going to hit with an audience. I think what's nice is that at the end of the day, I think we're not so focused on that in a way that we're chasing that laugh. We're doing things that we think are funny, and we hope that people find them funny or find them interesting. If the whole show seems cohesive and makes sense, that's the win for us. And so we're concerned about a different rhythm than the rhythm that you have with a live studio audience where you feel their energy and you have to kind of shift with that. And look, if you've got a live audience and the audience doesn't like the joke, they let you know in that moment, and you kind of either bail on the joke or you have to comment on it. And this, we just kind of have to live with the jokes we tell. And
yeah,
there's something that's fun about that. It's a different challenge, and it's one that we've enjoyed playing around with.
Yeah, in some sense, it must be sort of liberating to be able to do that. But, you know, you also have to have a lot of confidence in yourself and in the material to be able to put that out there, not knowing whether material is going to land or not for weeks or, I don't know, maybe even months. When you're working on problem areas, do you ever go out to the clubs and try out the material before you put it in the show?
Yeah, it would be kind of tough to say, okay, imagine you're in a weird PBS like bunker, yeah, and I'm talking to you about solar energy, and so I think in that way
really
it becomes,
gotta set it up for him.
Yeah, it's a lot of setup, and so
yeah,
there's just not the time to really do that, and I think that's then what becomes kind of cool about the show, and at least the way that we make it. We shoot things, we cut them together, we play them for writers, producers, researchers, people, editors. Like, we're all kind of looking at it. And so when we're in those rooms, people feel compelled to share. And so if something doesn't work for somebody, they'll raise it. And we are, I think that to me is maybe one of the most creatively collaborative times that we have, mm-hmm, with the show, is as we're watching these things. So it gives me an opportunity to see things through their eyes in a way that you don't necessarily get with a live audience. A live audience, they laugh or they don't, but you don't really get that opportunity to then look into, well, why did they laugh? Or what did, you know,
yeah,
what made that funny to you?
Yeah, when you're deciding on topics for the show, is there a ratio of comedy versus relevance that you're looking for when you're tossing around ideas in the writer's room?
I don't know if there's a ratio. I think as we're going through it, there's obviously a certain amount of information that we have to express. And I think that's true of our show, that's true of The Daily Show, that's true of Last Week Tonight, Patriot Act, so many of the shows that are like problem areas in that way, as far as doing, you know, satirical takes on news issues, social issues, cultural issues. And so I think the approach is always, well, we need the information to tell these jokes. We need the setup. And, you know, it's the same, I think in some ways it's a similar approach to writing a stand-up joke, that, well, I need the setup. I need you to understand why my life is weird so that this joke lands. I need you to understand why this trip I took was so important that when I tell you the joke, it resonates with you. And I don't think it's that different than to switch that into, I need you to understand what's going on in the world or with this subject so that these jokes land. At The Daily Show, I think one of the things that always stood out to me was that I would have people come up to me and they would say, oh, I get all my news from The Daily Show. And I always thought that was bullshit. And
yeah,
that's not, and it's not in a way to like say anything dismissive about them, but
right,
if you watched The Daily Show with no context for what Fox News is, or with no context for who Mitch McConnell is,
yeah,
you'd wonder, why are they making fun of that old man?
I mean, if nothing else, they're kind of missing out on the joke.
Yeah.
My read on you, Wyatt, is that you seem a lot less interested in the gossipy Washington insider stuff or reveling in schadenfreude over every dumb thing that comes out of the White House these days than you are about working through real problems that actually impact people's real lives and working through those issues and somehow getting to the other side of it to a place where you have the beginnings of a solution or at least a roadmap for how to get there. Is that a pretty much accurate read on you?
Sure, I'd take that read. Yeah. If you're FBI profiling me, I'd buy that. I think that there's obviously frustrating things that are happening in the country, and there are obviously things that incense me, but I can control the things that are in front of me. I can control the things that I can control, and we can sit here every day and talk about the Mueller report, but talking about the Mueller report isn't going to help a kid in the Bronx who's at a school that has a 95% poverty rate and no resources get a quality and equitable education. Complaining about the Mueller report isn't going to get, isn't going to do anything to somehow better the relationship that communities of color have with law enforcement or with things that they need. Mm-hmm. And so I think to me, it feels like those are the things that I can focus on. We could talk about 2020 all day, but ultimately, what are we doing in between then to actually affect and impact people's lives right now? We continue to complain about how we're the richest country in the world, and yet we have high rates of poverty and, a wealth gap. And there's only so much yelling at Washington that, outside of like running for office and trying to overhaul the system in some way, like those things are all great and you should vote and you should be involved in the political process. But I think sometimes when we get so caught up in the yelling, we allow ourselves to say, well, the only time I need to get involved civically is when there is a vote to be cast and there are things that could be happening right now that people could get involved with. There are school board decisions and things that are happening in people's local school districts that they could be having an impact with right now. Yeah. There are things that are happening in city council meetings that people could be having an impact in their own communities right now. And so I think to me, those are the things that are just as important and in some cases maybe more important than, spending 4 years wishing that it was 2020.
Right, right. Not everything comes from the White House. And I have to say, you're probably the only late night show that rarely, if ever, mentions Donald Trump. Do you think that the very mention of Trump is just too polarizing that it becomes a non-starter and is sort of antithetical to the goal of bringing folks together and the kind of conversations that you're trying to start on this show?
The overall thought with the show is that there's a national conversation that happens on just about everything. There's a national conversation that happens on healthcare. But when you actually go into a community and you start talking to the people who live within a community, there's a conversation that they're having. And that conversation is different from city to city, from community to community. And so I think to me, it's understanding, oh, what does that conversation look like in this city and with this community? And what does that conversation look like in this other city with this other community? And maybe there's some overlap there, because at the end of the day with the national conversation isn't as interested in the nuance of what's going on from community to community. And it's not as interested in living in a story for as long as it takes. It's those national conversations that you see on the cable news networks, they have, 5 to 7 minutes to devote to something.
Yeah.
And then they move on to the next thing. It's like, and it just becomes a cycle. And so I think sometimes when we get so caught up in the national conversation, it allows then the national conversation to dictate the rhetoric. And that rhetoric becomes, I think, like you said, polarizing, but it also becomes distilled into sound bites. Mm-hmm. And it's just people shouting sound bites at one another. And when you start actually talking to people and looking at people in the eyes and hearing what they have to say and why they have to say it, I think there is a place for understanding there, and there's a place for perhaps trying to see where that overlap exists and see where we are trying to move in the same direction. And if so, how do we find the momentum to do that where we can actually create some kind of a change?
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Wyatt Cenac when we come back in just a minute. If there's something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, BetterHelp Online Counseling can help. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment and get help at your own time and at your own pace. Anything you share is confidential. And it's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions as well as chat and text with your therapist. If for some reason you're not happy with your counselor, though, you can request a new one at any time for no additional charge. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/kick. Then simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/kick. And now, back to the show. In season one of Problem Areas, you spent about half of every episode investigating the state of policing in America. Were you surprised that HBO was down to let you take that much time with one subject and really let you explore all the nuances?
I wasn't, because I think when I pitched the show, that was one of the things that they were very excited about, was sort of taking this longer lens look at something. And, you know, I have the benefit of having a model that they could already point to, which was Last Week Tonight. And they look at the success of John's show and see that, okay, there is a recipe for this. There is an appetite for taking a deeper dive on something. And so I think in that way, they were very excited about it. And you know, obviously having John as an executive producer on the show, there's already there's a shared DNA that we have from The Daily Show and with our approaches. And so I got nothing but support from the network as I came in, and I really am appreciative to them for that. They really have been great allies as I've tried to make this show and as we've tried to make something that that we can all be proud of.
Did you find it challenging to spark a nuanced conversation about an issue as polarizing as the police last season?
Again, I think when you get into a particular city, it stops feeling as polarized. And that's not to say that there aren't issues within a city, but all of a sudden, once you start talking about those issues and those people start to look at one another as people and start to talk about it outside of the sort of national conversation, they all want to try to find an answer. There was an openness to that conversation because at the end of the day, these people all live in the same city, and they can't just, it's not that easy to just pack up their tents and go. And when I look at, you know, we did a story in Elgin, Illinois about community policing, and the police department, they had a program where they had officers living in certain communities, and the idea was to try to foster a relationship with those communities. And unfortunately, an officer shot and killed a woman in the town of, or in the city of Elgin, and people were rightly upset. And it was not
happy situation. There were harsh words and there was yelling and there were emotions. And I think what to me seems hopeful is they're talking, and it might not be, you know, the most civil discourse in the moment because it is emotional. It's a person's life, but they're talking. And I think that's what gets lost sometimes in the national conversation is it's easy for people to kind of entrench themselves in their camps. And I think especially with law enforcement, so often you see this blue wall of silence go up. And I think going into a city like Elgin and seeing that they're trying to have a conversation, the community is trying to talk to law enforcement, and law enforcement seems to be open to engaging in that conversation in a way that I feel like I hadn't really seen law enforcement agencies do. But just the fact that there's a conversation, that to me feels like, okay, that's very different from a lot of the things that I've seen. And I don't think you get to see that if you're just having a bird's eye view.
Right.
I think when you actually get into a community, you hope that those communities are trying to have those discussions and trying to actually work together to find something that serves everyone fairly.
Right. And I have so many psychologists on the show who have said to me that the biggest problem with our discourse right now is that we're just hiding behind the anonymity of social media. And we're taking away the humanity of the other side. But it's amazing, and I see this with your show, what happens when a person can just put a face to whatever they perceive to be their political enemies.
Yeah. And maybe some of that comes from stand-up, in that when you're on stage, you're obviously trying to make people laugh. But if somebody doesn't laugh, or if somebody's offended, or they speak up and they heckle you, they're in the room and you can talk to them and you can have that conversation. And I think there's something in that relationship that as a comedian that you have with an audience where you can talk to somebody and, you know, because in a comedy club, it's either if they're being unruly or you don't like them, you can throw them out. But I feel like more often than not, you see people try to engage and try to figure out, okay, you're heckling, what is this about? And I think there are real moments of humanity that happen from that. One thing, or one person, I should say, that is so kind of amazing to watch do that is Sarah Silverman. And it's a real shame that Hulu canceled her show, I Love You America, because I think as a show that really was trying to engage in discourse and in civil discourse, she was doing a great job of it. And I think on more than a few occasions, Sarah has engaged with people on social media who've been terrible, terrible to her.
Yeah, I know.
And she's had real conversations with them. And all of a sudden, they are actually sharing with her and opening up, and their humanity starts to come through, and they see her humanity, and they oftentimes apologize for being mean to her in the first place. And as unfortunate as it is that her show's not on anymore, I hope that if there's anything I can do with my show, it's continue to push forward that idea of discourse that I think she did so well.
Yeah. And you tackled policing from a lot of different angles, and you do a great job of talking to all sides of the issue, the cops, the people who train them, as well as the Black Lives Matter activists and the victims of police violence. As a Black man in America who has probably had some not so pleasant experiences with cops of your own, you obviously must come to this with a strong point of view. Did you find yourself having to keep your own biases in check while you were making problem areas? And did some of those feelings maybe even start to change by the end of the season?
I mean, I think my biases are always going to walk in. I'm always walking in with my opinion. What I tried to do with everything is also walk in with curiosity and try to understand. I don't understand, and you know, even after doing 10 episodes, I don't understand why we invest as much as we do in policing as the answer for what is security in our country, when security could also mean making sure that you have healthy meals and housing for all and healthcare for all and quality education for all and mental health facilities and resources for all. All of those things feel like they also fall under the definition of security and safety. I think about with one episode in particular, we went to Los Angeles and we were talking about mental health and just the fact that police officers have many, many interactions with people who are in mental health distress. And they didn't feel equipped to handle those things. Yet they are the ones who have to do it. And there was a sense of, yeah, there should be more resources devoted to these things. And so in that way, it felt like, okay, well, there's something that we agree on. You agree that we should have more resources to do these things. The challenging question becomes, well, where do we get those resources? But you seem open and amenable to that idea. And so now is it, do we take those resources from the law enforcement budget? Or do we find them somewhere else? Can you then take that a step further and advocate for it in a way that it might actually go against some of your own interests? Mm-hmm. It might mean that you have to get rid of some of your SWAT vehicles. Maybe you don't need a tank.
Yeah.
And that tank money could be used, you know, to expand the mental health resources that exist in a city and do things where, okay, maybe it's not just about having police officers patrolling streets, but maybe it's about having social workers who can walk beats and who can check in with neighborhoods, and there are the resources to do that. Yeah, and thinking about all those things, I can't help but ask for police officers who have been told they have an incredibly dangerous job where there are a lot of stressors. Do we need to be having a conversation about what do they do when they're in some sort of mental health distress? How do they deal with those things? And does the way that they deal with those things, does it in any way overlap with how they interact with the community when the community is dealing with those things? And so I think all those things feel like I just kind of try to turn my bias into questions and let those drive where we go.
Yeah, and it is interesting how many of these big problem issues boil down in many ways to just a matter of resources. And that kind of comes into it in season two as well, because your big theme this time around is education. You get into school choice and charter schools versus public schools. And it seems like that's a whole other conversation that's coming from a standpoint of having limited resources. And, you know, if you put them here, they're going to hurt someone else on some other side. And, you know, it almost seems like Sophie's Choice, you know?
And I think that's what education has been for a lot of parents, is a Sophie's Choice. You know, I think Nicole Hannah-Jones, who I'm very grateful gave us time this season within the show, she writes very beautifully about the struggle that she had when it came time to make decisions about her own daughter's education and what it is that she wanted for her daughter. And there is this Sophie's Choice of, do I do what I think is best for my child, or do I do what I think is best for all children?
Yeah.
And how do I navigate that? And how do I do that in a society where just because I go out on a limb and I make a choice, I'm not 100% sure that every other parent is going to make the same choice?
Yeah.
And so that becomes, I think, really scary. And so I think when you see parents make the decisions that they make, I can't begrudge any parent for choosing to send their child to a private school or a public school or a charter school or a parochial school. They're doing what they think is best for their child. But I think the question becomes, in doing what's best for your child, is there a way to do something that's also the best for your child, but could benefit all children in your district, in your city, in your state.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, at some point this season, do you plan on digging into the whole college admissions scandal?
I don't know if I'm going to directly dig into it too much. I feel like there's definitely just a... I feel like the surface has kind of been scratched on that.
Okay.
But I think that there's probably more to come. I feel like there's, you know, there's not that much that's surprising in terms of what that story is. It shouldn't have been as surprising to people as it was. I think, you know, we as a society have joked for decades about, you know, some dumb rich kid getting into college because daddy bought a building and bought the new wing of the science lab. That's been a joke that I think has, you know, you've seen it in movies, you've seen it in on television shows, you've heard it mentioned about politicians. That was, I feel like, something that was mentioned often about George Bush, that he, you know, got into college because not just because his father went there, but because daddy paid somebody off. And so in that way, that college admissions story, the actual story itself wasn't shocking. The fact that you've got, you know, you're putting people on the crew team as the way to get them into college, I think that's where there's sort of an amusing, oh, wow, this is how you're scamming the system now. But I feel like with that in mind, there's probably more to this story that I'm waiting to see if it gets scratched a little more and we don't hear more about this stuff. So,
And in between these serious segments that deal with societal problems, you also have some lighter moments where you're talking about recent trends and other kind of issues. You address goat yoga at some point this season. I keep hearing this everywhere, and I truly don't understand the concept. I get yoga, and I know what a goat is, but when you combine those two words, you may as well be saying chicken genie or something. In fact, I take that back. Chicken genie actually makes more sense than goat yoga. What the hell is goat yoga?
Goat yoga, I as well had no idea what goat yoga was. And I thought, wait, people are doing yoga with like adult goats? What's going on? And so what it is it's people doing yoga with baby goats. And so baby goats are less inclined to, you know, hurt and maim you. They're not strong enough. But it's an interesting thing. I think for the people that do it, they seem to really enjoy it. And I think it's almost like having a companion animal on like a flight or something like that. But the goats will climb on people and... I'll say that watching it, I didn't do it, but watching it, what did seem kind of like nice about it was that people were kind of giggling through the whole thing. And I feel like whatever insecurities people may have in a yoga class, it seemed like those went away because they were all just kind of, they didn't have time to be awkward about their bodies or their inability to make a position because there was a goat on their head. I will say though, you know, if you're gonna go to goat yoga, they're baby goats. They're not house trained. And so you go in knowing that there's a chance a goat's gonna take a piss on your yoga mat. And
So bring a change of yoga pants.
Yeah.
Again, season two of Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas debuts Friday, April 5th at 11 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Wyatt, good luck with the show, and thanks for talking with me.
Thank you. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Wyatt Cenac for coming on the podcast. Season 2 of Wyatt Cenac's Problem Areas debuts Friday, April 5th at 11 p.m. Eastern on HBO. For more on what Wyatt's up to, including upcoming stand-up dates, visit wyattcenac.com and follow him on Twitter at @WyattCenac. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat or text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Kick-Ass News listeners can even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already, and if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.